Hello, and welcome back to the Joint Venture Podcast, Inspiration Insights. This week, joining us for the first time is our new reporter, Ash.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
And we also have our senior analyst, Chandra Chin, too.
Hey, Oliver.
On the episode this week, we are going to talk about a lot of news coming out, particularly Germany, in the last week. We're going to cover that. And then after that, we're going to talk about the situation in Ukraine, particularly focusing on the financing and requirements of the rebuilding effort, looking forward to a post-war world. After that, we've also got Chandra, who's going to talk us through some of his latest insights and articles around the operation and maintenance of wind farms. If you're a regular listener, you'll have heard the first parts of this series. We're going to wrap that up this week. But, as mentioned, we're going to begin with the news. Take it away, Ash.
Thank you, Oliver. So, like you said, there's a lot happening in Germany. To start with, the German bank Berenberg has reached a second close on its Green Energy Debt Fund 4, which targets investments in the EU and OECD countries. The fund, which has a target size of about 300 to 500 million euros, has raised at least 100 million, although they haven't really announced the exact figures. The fund offers competitive returns, which they say is in the mid to high single-digit range. And the fund managers noted that since the first closing, it has raised capital from 8 new investors and has already allocated 90% of the capital raised from the first close.
Yeah, that's a very significant fund. Hopefully get some more details on that in the coming few days. But there's more news in Germany on the auction side.
That's right. The first results are in from Germany's recent onshore wind capacity auction. And once again, it was significantly undersubscribed. And the main reason Germany has had these problems is because it has had a lot of delays when it comes to getting projects approved. Not to mention that it has a massive queue for projects seeking grid connection, which have been causing backlogs that have put off potential bidders from participating.
Yeah, that's interesting, Ash. And that reminds me, we did talk about German auctions as a whole in our Risk Watch report, which we released a couple of months ago. At least in the German market, they do understand that undersubscribed auctions have been an ongoing trend at least since 2018. And sort of in response to that, the German Bundestag increased their ceiling tariff by 25% in January 2023 to potentially attract a stronger response from auctioneers and developers. But still, with this recent auction, there's a lack of interest. So the question still stands, is it investable if there are long grid connection queues and the permitting stage of a project is so long that one struggles to raise debt?
It's true, because Germany's been putting a lot of pressure on its renewable sector to try and reach these very ambitious renewable targets that it's been setting, particularly driven by the green agenda within the German government itself. However, if the infrastructure is not there, if you cannot attract the investors, then Germany is most likely going to fall short of its net zero targets. Exactly how undersubscribed was this auction, Ash?
So there was a proposed 2.9 gigawatts of capacity, and out of that, 1.5 gigawatts were awarded to bidders, representing 127 bids, of which 7 were excluded. Now, this doesn't sound like it's particularly impressive, but things are picking up slightly. So far this year, about 3 gigawatts of capacity have been given away. This was the second auction in 2023, and this is almost as much as that was awarded in the entirety of 2022. This suggests that the German government is actually paying attention, and all the measures that Chandra mentioned have been working, and they're speeding up the grid connections. Speaking of the German auctions, there's also been some drama in the New York auctions. Chandra, can you tell me something about that?
Yeah, so all the way back in 2019, New York had its first offshore wind auction, in which BP and Equinor were very successful. And it now come to the time where the projects are in the permitting phase, trying to get various permits to construct. And because in the US, they have adopted a state-by-state auction mechanism, that means each state is responsible for the legislative processes that the projects need to go through to obtain these permits. And in New York, this has been quite a lengthy process. Already, there have been hints that these projects, which are the Empire Wind 1 and 2 and Beacon 1 and 2, will be severely delayed, which affects the risk of failure of these projects and the ability for them to raise sufficient debt and find a suitable buyer for a PPA or relevant revenue stream. So what's interesting about that is that it's taken very long to grant construction permits. Equinor and BP are very keen on getting this done very quickly, But the process seems to be quite slow. And the question about whether the United States should move from a state-by-state auction mechanism to a countrywide federal auction mechanism lingers on because of situations like this.
Ash, what else has been going on?
So now moving on from the New York auction to German companies, NordLB is financing the construction of a 48-megawatt solar portfolio in Italy, which has been developed by MSC Solar and Envalue, both are German companies. The schemes are currently at different stages of construction, with the portfolio now expected to reach commercial operation by the end of 2023. The financing has been structured on a multi-borrower project financing basis, which has been divided into various facilities. Combined together, this represents a debt investment of 41 million euros, and a portion of the long-term debt was made available by KfW through NordLB, two banks that have a lengthy history of working together on financing deals.
Yeah, interesting that they've put the emphasis on merchant exposure in this deal. Genva, you've been doing some research on that. Do you think this is fits into the trends we've been talking about in recent episodes?
Yes, it does. Being located in Italy, there is a very good solar resource, and even if one is forecasting energy resource and production very conservatively, that is by using P99 or P90 values from advisors they're working with, it's still very possible to use that resource and future production with the curves one has to have certainty of the returns of your project in Italy with that good resource. So it does make sense that this has been considered. And we might just see more of this as various other banks and financiers become more comfortable with renewables as an asset class working within the electricity markets.
Fantastic news. And we will keep a close eye on that space. Thank you for the German roundup. I think we have a couple of things in the UK we wanted to round up as well, Ash.
Indeed we do. So the 500-megawatt Longfield solar farm, which is being built by EDF Renewables and Padero Solar, has won development consent from the UK government. It is thought that the project will be comprised of a solar array that will be co-located with battery storage. And another bit of UK news, the Gore Street Energy Storage Fund is increasing its existing revolving credit facility with Santander. As a result of the deal, the value of the RCF will rise from 15 million to 50 million. To do this, Gore Street has gained £35 million of incremental debt, which has been arranged and syndicated by Santander UK and Banco Santander.
Thank you for the roundup, Ash. Now, moving on a bit, we've mentioned at the top of the show we're going to talk about Ukraine and the rebuilding effort and the scale of that infrastructure challenge and the financing behind it. There was a story in the news this week which perhaps is the first step towards some kind of conciliated rebuilding effort. Ash, can you bring us up to date on this?
So the UK and Ukraine have signed a memorandum of understanding on the creation of a new fund to accelerate the reconstruction of restoration efforts. The UK is providing an initial contribution of £10 million and the rest of the £62 million which has been allocated will be delivered in installments until 2025. This fund could go towards small modular reactors, green hydrogen, small-scale solar, including for household and energy efficiency, onshore and offshore wind power, and others. So this is particularly important because during the ongoing war, Russian forces have been constantly targeting energy infrastructure in Ukraine. They've been trying to create blackouts and power cuts using drone strikes and missiles. And given the damage caused by the ongoing invasion, Ukrainian officials are looking for up to $40 billion in funding the first part of a Green Marshall Plan. Ukrainian officials hope to build 50 million tons of green steel industry in the country, as the traditional iron and steel industry was a big part of its exports before the war. And in order to raise these funds, Ukraine plans to collaborate with multilateral institutions like the World Bank, the European Investment Bank, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Yeah, Oliver, and you focus a lot on the Green Marshall Plan this week. What can you say about that?
Yes, so it's a really interesting angle that is sort of just emerging in the conversation in the last couple of weeks. Now, we're not a geopolitical war tracking podcast here, but the listeners will be aware of the events in Ukraine and more particularly the events behind the Russian lines, including the mercenary Wagner Group in the last couple of weeks, which have perhaps moved the dial a lot, at least in the conversations around the war, towards maybe this war isn't going to last as long as we thought. So a lot of thought has been moved to the post-war period. And that's kind of what this Green Marshall Plan is all about. So as you mentioned, Ash, the Ukrainian government is seeking the first installment, they've called it, of this plan, which is $40 billion US dollars. It's called the Green Marshall Plan. I'm not sure if, just to sort of clarify the reference there, this is talking about the original Marshall Plan, which was the post-World War II European rebuilding effort in that the United States used to finance the reconstruction of many urban centres within Europe. So the original Marshall Plan cost in the region of tens of billions of dollars. The Ukrainians have said that in total, they're going to seek $400 billion in terms of reconstruction. Now, this is a figure that was produced by the World Bank as an estimate for how much damage the war has done so far on Ukrainian infrastructure. And obviously, it doesn't come anywhere close to summarizing the total human cost of the tragedy.
That's interesting to hear. A very large number is coming out of this, as expected. But I think an industry of interest would be the iron and steel industry. Is there any sort of innovations that are being sought through this Marshall Plan?
Yeah, there are. Indeed, the fact that it's been called in the initial phases a Green Marshall Plan kind of speaks to this. So the Ukrainian government have been in London in the last week doing funding rounds. I think that the story that Ash mentioned at the top about the UK government contributing towards a new fund to accelerate reconstruction came about as a result of this. So that was a £10 million fund with £62 million planned by 2025. However, the UK government has also agreed in the past week to provide £2.35 billion worth of bank loan guarantees over 3 years for the rebuilding of Kiev, and particularly the focus of this first phase of this Green Marshall Plan is on that steel sector. So one of the things which has been pushed very strongly by the Ukrainians on this is that they want to talk about not just the rebuilding effort, the humanitarian side of things, but they want to be able to rebuild their economy post-war. And before the war, around 10% of Ukraine's GDP was reliant on iron and steel production, employing around 600,000 people in Ukraine. So this is a huge part of the country's well-being. And of course, if they want to bounce back post-war, they're going to need tradable goods. They're going to need foreign exchange to build up their own economy once again. And they focused on this, I think, particularly highlighting that although it was obviously a huge moneymaker for the country, 15% of carbon emissions from Ukraine were also from iron and steel production. So they're targeting green steel, and they're talking a lot about using hydrogen, clean hydrogen, renewable hydrogen production in steel production and sort of building up a model of the new clean industrial sector. Listeners, if you remember back to last year, the Mariupol steelworks became world famous during the siege of that city, and it became very clear around that time that much of the infrastructure that had previously existed is either severely damaged or completely out of action. The remaining iron and steel works within unoccupied Ukraine, of course, at the moment are very heavily orientated towards the war effort, as you would expect. But in the future, they're looking to build out this Green Marshall Plan, as mentioned, this green recovery with these new techniques. Having, in some areas, had the slate wiped clean, it's an opportunity to rebuild in a green and sustainable way.
So what can you tell me about Ukraine's energy profile before the war, and what's it going to look like after the war?
Pre-war, Ukraine was a net exporter of energy in the form of natural gas. It has quite a large natural gas reserve. Of course, it was tangled up in the Russian natural gas supplies moving across Europe, which were hugely disrupted at the beginning of the war. But Ukraine is not concerned about its energy security from Russia in the future. However, as you mentioned, Ash, there's been a lot of focus in the war on weaponizing energy. First of all, weaponizing it on the European-wide scale in terms of natural gas markets, but also energy infrastructure has been a target within Ukraine. I actually spoke to Professor Irina Zapatrina, a prominent Ukrainian economist and formerly deputy minister in the Ukrainian government, current chair of the Ukrainian PPP Center, who really highlighted the priorities for the rebuilding effort. She said to me, it's first of all going to be about energy infrastructure because we were without light for most of the day during the winter. It should be about the water supply, the heating supply infrastructure, and it should also be about residential homes because many people now have no place to live. So it kind of really brings home that there is a huge humanitarian question to be answered here. And that's what the Ukrainians are also pushing as well. Of course, the green agenda, they're pushing the wider humanitarian efforts in looking for these funds around Europe and the US.
And so going forward, what should Ukraine do to attract this sort of investment into the economy?
So in the short term, it's going to be about targeting those essential public services, public infrastructure that I mentioned previously. But there's also going to be a huge international effort, and we're going to need to build up new funding mechanisms, and Ukraine's going to need the administrative capacity to deal with prioritizing projects. So another person I spoke to about this was David Baxter, a leading expert in international development and PPPs, who told me that one of the most important things is that there has to be a sense of trust, that the money that's being given, donated, lent, loaned, whatever the system is actually going to be used for the projects that it's been designated for. In the past, Ukraine has had a problem of corruption, and that's something that has been addressed in recent years, but there's still a worry for that, especially because it's quite a small administration, a small civil service in the country. So building up the capacity to deal with incoming funds is obviously going to be an important part of this. And also prioritizing those projects that are most important also has to come alongside making sure that there are deliverable goals. So if Ukraine can sustain the narrative, the story of every time someone pays into their reconstruction, they can say within a relatively short order, here is something we've done with the money. Here is a school that's reconstruction. Here is a train which is now running. Here is a town which didn't have water that now has water. The more of that that they can keep up, the momentum and the sense that the rebuild effort is working, then the more money can come their way and the more confidence people will feel in contributing to the Green Marshall Plan. So by showcasing tangible progress in rebuilding effort, Ukraine can maintain international support and funding. Meanwhile, it's important to note, of course, while we're talking about this, the war is ongoing. We cannot wrap this up in a bow yet. There's going to have to be an extensive period of reflection, of research, of groundwork, of survey, of working out precisely what the costs are. As we say, the World Bank figure is just an estimate. So there's going to have to be a lot of legwork done on the ground for this. Yeah, we're going to follow this story for as long as it takes. It's time now to move on from geopolitical concerns to the technical. So over the last few weeks, we've had a series of articles on wind turbines and maintenance and operation phases, the kind of stuff that we don't talk about all that often, but really does affect the bottom line of these projects and constantly needs attention and review. So Chandwa, what has been happening in the O&M market recently?
Yeah, so to begin, I think a couple of weeks ago we discussed how turbines are getting larger and larger. And with new technology, especially floating offshore wind, these ever larger turbines are going further out to sea. And that raises a lot of concerns for operations and maintenance suppliers and contractors who build out these facilities. On top of that, for those who are competing in auctions, there's several auctions who are considering non-price criteria. And these O&M suppliers and contractors need to be aware of this. And so what's happening in the O&M world, with a particular focus on floating wind, is can these targets be met and achieved economically in today's market?
Okay, so let's get down to the nitty-gritty on this. What are the challenges that are affecting offshore wind installation and maintenance?
Yeah, so it all revolves around availability and expertise. So in terms of availability, like we said, as turbines are getting much larger, there's now very few vessels that are capable of carrying components, structural components, from port out to sea. And on top of that, there's very few cranes which can lift components up to 150 meters, which is where turbines are getting to these days. And so if we're talking about floating offshore wind, the model that's been followed by fixed bottom turbines, which is the tow to port model, essentially having a quayside port where the structural elements are held and a vessel transports them to site and a crane on the vessel constructs the platform. But with floating, because the platform can float, there is now the availability of floating to floating construction and maintenance. And with that, there's several options. So number one, as we said just now, the availability of vessels that can work in conjunction with the floating turbine is very limited. But there's several advancements in technology where, as the platform itself is being built, the structural platform is being built, one can attach an add-on crane to the structure. So at that point, you're integrating construction into the wind turbine itself. But then on top of that, another thing to think about is, because the structure itself is floating, there's various degrees of motion that are being subjected to the structure. And can these add-on cranes survive these motions? And can they be utilized in a way that's economically viable? That is not known yet because the technology is so new.
I can see why you would opt for a crane which was essentially mounted to the thing you're constructing. Because if you try and to do, as you say, floating to floating construction, just think about the sort of all the different types of motion you'd have to account for there. It seems like a real challenge. So with that in mind, and also the option of tow to port, which route to construction is preferable, would you say?
Well, at the moment, because the technology is so new, there isn't the preferred method. The question is still out for debate to all developers in the floating offshore wind space. At the commercial scale, at least, the question is, do you fundamentally believe in in-situ operations, that would revolve around tow-to-port, or do you fundamentally believe in floating-to-floating operations? If you're the first, are you able to make a five-year plan for making dynamic lifts a reality in relation to add-on cranes? Are you able to make these dynamic lifts with high tonnage in varying weather conditions? And have good access to tower, nacelle, hub, and blade components with wind turbine structures that are 150 meters plus tall. And if you are the latter, can you plan to plug and play your floating offshore wind turbine? In that, are you able to disconnect your floating offshore wind turbine from your offshore array and tow it to port successfully within a specific window that doesn't minimize the operational efficiency of your whole asset? So there's a lot to consider, really, and it's still up in the air, and the two methods are up for debate, and we'll have to see which is more efficient.
I'm struck by your use of language there when you're talking about which method developers believe in. Like, that's not something we hear very often. It always sort of comes down to the analysis, the most cost-efficient method, the safest method, the most secure methods. But as you say, I guess the research just isn't there yet.
Yeah, and so it comes down to whether developer A believes that method one is the more economically viable option, the more profitable option for them, or if developer B thinks option B is the more profitable option. And we'll just have to wait and see what works best.
I guess with floating, and I guess any new technology, there's going to be things that you don't know, kinks that you haven't ironed out until after generation one. And this seems like it's going to be one of those things, which actually maybe will not be immediately apparent, because, as you say, this is going to be all most relevant during construction, late phase construction, and the actual operation. So it might be quite a while before we know the answers to these questions. Is there anything being done on the side of port infrastructure to facilitate this transition to these new methods?
Yes. So particularly in the UK, the government in October, all the way back in October 2021, announced up to £160 million to be allocated towards manufacturing facilities and to scale up offshore wind technology deployment to achieve a net zero objective. Now, that value may be on the low side, but on top of that, there are also several leasing rounds. The recent INTOG leasing round by ScotWind, and ScotWind itself doing more leasing rounds for floating offshore wind, which account for non-price criteria. And what are these non-price criteria? It's the building up of a supply chain to support floating offshore wind, the building up of port facilities and making vessels available. And so with government incentives and with auctions in place, trying to make sure that port availability and relevant ports are built up in time with relevant vessels, in the next few years we might just see the nature of floating offshore wind come to life, really.
Thank you very much, Chandwa. One more story before we finish off. Last week, leader of the UK Labour Party, Keir Starmer, put forward his platform for the next UK general election when it comes to energy and net zero policy. The platform he announced revolved around the creation of the new publicly owned body, GB Energy, to be headquartered in Scotland. This was announced by Anna Sawa, leader of Scottish Labour. The claim is that this strategy will create 500,000 new jobs, 50,000 of which would be in Scotland. Among other commitments, the party committed to backing carbon capture, hydrogen, nuclear and tidal power, doubling the UK's onshore wind capacity, trebling the UK's solar capacity and quadrupling the offshore wind installations in the UK. The party also committed to put severe limitations on exploration licences for new oil and gas in the North Sea. However, the existing projects there would be allowed to continue operation.
Are there any highlights in terms of what Labour plans to do that's different from what the Conservative government is doing right now?
So there are a few points which are interesting. So we've talked on this podcast before about what's been called the UK's onshore wind moratorium. It's very difficult to get projects off the ground in the UK in the onshore wind space. An effective ban been the policy from the Conservative government. And when Rishi Sunak became the Prime Minister, he did pledge to end this. However, the delivery of that promise has been rather lacking. It's still incredibly difficult to get permitting. Things have not improved as much as the industry was hoping, certainly. So that's one thing that is a certain point of difference. And obviously, the commitment to this publicly owned body is something completely different from the government's own strategy, but does speak more to the Labour Party being more happy to intervene in the energy sector and the economy in general if it thinks it is necessary. Also interesting is the commitment to start a new national sovereign wealth fund, similar to how Norway has used the revenues from its gas fields to build up a sovereign fund that's now investing heavily in renewable energy. That's a model that the Labour Party is clearly emulating. And Keir Starmer also mentioned in his speech some quite specific details about a CFD contract, which is kind of you almost wouldn't expect from a high-level political discussion. But he did commit to reforming the CFD auctions to make sure that that CFDs are awarded to companies which prioritise the delivery of jobs and secure supply chains within the UK. This is probably inspired heavily by the sort of measures that we've seen in the US recently with the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, that is, which offer huge tax credits to projects which fulfil certain employment and supply chain requirements within the US and specific US allies.
That's really interesting, Oliver. And I noticed one thing pointed out was they also mentioned insulating homes and increasing energy efficiency, which is one of the reasons the UK was struggling so much this year in terms of their household energy bills. That was one of the reasons why, despite not receiving as much natural gas from Russia as, say, the rest of Europe, they still had some of the highest energy bills across the continent.
Yes, of course. And the insulation point has been brought up a lot of times in the past, but governments have backed away from it for being so prohibitively expensive. It certainly seems that this plan is going to at least attempt once more to address the issue of insulated homes in the UK. The plan has estimated to save £1,400 a year off energy bills for families. That's of course an estimate, and we'll probably not be able to compare directly to that in a couple of years' time if that is that Labour Party do win the next election, which we have to seriously consider given opinion polls at the moment. They have been ahead for quite a long time. So these kind of plans are something which I think in the next year or so, we don't know when a general election is going to be just yet, but these kind of political considerations, I think the sector is starting to take note of. It hasn't all been clean sailing in the commitments that the party has made. The headline figure that they announced last year for investment in the energy sector in renewable energy was £28 billion per year for various energy related initiatives. However, they have since backed away from this figure, blaming the current state of the economy and how much more limited capacity of the UK government to borrow at the moment in the current economic climate. However, they have committed to reaching this figure, or as they say, ramp up to it by the end of their first parliament. And that is it for us for another week. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to our contributors. Congratulations on your first episode, Ash.
Thank you, Oliver.
And thanks once again, Chandler.
Thanks, Oliver.
We'll be back again with more news and analysis from the energy sector next week. Until then, goodbye.
Bye.